And you may never have taken a flight to Vernal, Utah or Rockland, Maine, but you've helped pay for air service to those towns and many more under a federal program that subsidizes commercial flights to small airports. Some communities consider the $175 million program an economic lifeline. Critics call it wasteful. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
It's not often that you'll see a crowd this big at the airport in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Hey, y'all gather around right in here.
But last month, scores of people crowded into the tiny terminal to help Mayor Mike Bush celebrate something that other airports take for granted. For the first time in more than a year, Hot Springs, a city with fewer than 40,000 residents, is being served by a commercial airline.
We've got airline service, y'all. Let's get my...
Now, if you're used to flying into bigger cities, the Hot Springs service may be a bit underwhelming. It's provided by a small carrier called Seaport, which offers three daily round trips to Memphis on a single-engine, nine-passenger propeller plane. But Airport Director George Downey says even that level of service is a big deal for Hot Springs community leaders.
It's very important for economic development because it is something positive that they can answer to any company wanting to relocate. Usually that's the first or second question on any questionnaire, do you have local air service?
Twice this decade, other airlines have started commercial flights to Hot Springs, only to discontinue them for a lack of passengers. So why is Seaport trying again? Partly because the company is getting a federal subsidy to do it. Hot Springs is among about 100 small cities in what's known as the Essential Air Service Program. That means airlines can receive hundreds or even thousands of dollars in federal subsidies for each passenger. Seaport CEO Kent Crayford says his company is getting more than $1 million a year to fly here.
One thing about the Essential Air Service Program is that the risk is mitigated by the subsidization of the air service.
But without the subsidy, there's no way you're here, right?
Without the subsidy, we wouldn't have taken the gamble to initiate service, no.
The Essential Air Service Program dates to the 1970s, when Congress deregulated the airlines and wanted to protect rural airports. But over the years, the subsidies have steadily grown and attracted their share of criticism. Many cities the program serves, including Hot Springs, are within about an hour's drive of bigger airports. And aviation consultant Michael Boyd says many of the flights are unnecessary.
If you're looking at a small community that is literally 150, 300 miles from a nearest airport, well, maybe you need to look at Essential Air Service. But when you're looking at something like Manistee, Michigan, where it's less than an hour to Traverse City, or Pueblo, Colorado, where it's 45 minutes to Colorado Springs, that's a waste of money.
Indeed, it's not unusual for subsidized flights to be mostly empty. Pueblo's million-dollar subsidy, for instance, funds fewer than 12 daily passengers. But efforts to reform the program have fallen flat in Congress, where Democrats and Republicans alike have guarded the money that flows to their airports. Ernest Istook is a former congressman who's now with the conservative Heritage Foundation.
Many members of Congress realize their communities are taking advantage of a bad system, but they feel they have no political choice other than to try to perpetuate it.
Here we go. Hey!
As Hot Springs officials cut the ribbon to inaugurate their service, they sidestepped political questions about the subsidies. But local gas station owner Ike Iqbal says he supports them. He says he'll take advantage of the new flights rather than driving to bigger airports in Little Rock or Dallas.
We pay tax, so that's my tax money, and the government is helping, so they can help us and make little money so our economy can survive.
So far, Seaport's Hot Springs service hasn't been hugely popular. In fact, there have been days since the startup when the airline hasn't carried a single passenger. But the company projects it will eventually sell about 7 tickets per flight and says the $160 round-trip fare, plus the $1 million a year in government money, will make the route profitable. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
China and other parts of Asia seem to have pulled through the global economic crisis in pretty good shape, though now there are fears that some of the region's economies are developing financial bubbles, which is why we've called Wall Street Journal's economics editor David Wessel, who's on the line with us right now. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
So, David, where exactly are we seeing signs of financial bubble?
Well, there are symptoms of bubbles in emerging markets in places like Brazil and particularly in Asia. The World Bank is worrying that stock markets in Asia, although they didn't have a great day today, are looking a little frothy, and particularly in real estate in China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Japan. The IMF has warned that a flood of foreign capital into Hong Kong is pushing real estate prices up to levels that it says are divorced from fundamental forces. In Singapore, for instance, home prices were up nearly 16% in the third quarter. That's the biggest one quarter gain in more than 28 years.
And so soon after this big economic crash, what's causing this?
Well, that's a good question. Part of it is driven by the amazing rebound of Asian economies, and they're doing better than Europe and the United States. And so you'd expect their markets to be stronger, and they are. But the fear is that there's so much cheap money in the world that the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank are keeping interest rates so low that people are borrowing here and taking the money and investing it in hot emerging markets. When you keep rates very low, people tend to borrow. And when they borrow, they tend to buy assets. And so you have this flood of foreign money into Asian markets where interest rates are higher, currencies are rising, so you make some money on that. And the prospects of a killing seem to be just enticing a lot of investors.
Stella, what makes it a bubble rather than something like a healthy market?
Well, you know, the problem is it's almost impossible to tell in advance. There are some signs, particularly in real estate in Asia, where you see these people lining up to buy apartments, or there was a big line to buy some kind of stall to sell fish balls in Hong Kong. You see that kind of exuberance of people who are buying something today, hoping they can sell it in a few months or a few years at a killing. That's a sign of a bubble. And then there's all these economists who sit around and they say, what should the price be, and is it going up too much? But the difficulty is that it's hard to tell in advance, and that makes it very hard to treat this problem.
Although, is there any way to treat it?
Well, yeah. I mean, one thing that could happen is that the central banks in the U.S. and Europe could raise interest rates. That would make borrowing more expensive, and people would have less money to put in those things. Now, it's a pretty blunt instrument, and it would have some unwelcome effects as well, like hurting the unemployment rate even more than it's hurt in the U.S. now. The other thing you can do, and some of this is going on, is make it harder for people to borrow. So, for instance, in Hong Kong, they're requiring bigger down payments. If you want to buy an expensive apartment in Hong Kong, you have to put more money down. That's to discourage speculation. And then in some Asian countries, the answer would be to let the currencies rise so much that foreign investors are no longer sure that the currency is going to keep rising, and they'll be a little reluctant to put money in. But a lot of Asian countries are reluctant to do that because that would hurt their exports, particularly at a time when China won't play ball and let its currency rise.
Now, okay, so financial bubbles possibly in Asia. What effect might it have on those of us here in the U.S.?
Well, a bubble is a great thing while it lasts. It's kind of like a high. And the problem comes when there's a bursting and things suddenly fall. That shakes markets, people lose money. And it's why the Federal Reserve now is thinking, we used to think we shouldn't worry about bubbles unless they pop. But as a result of this massive recession we have caused by a housing bubble and a credit bubble, they're now beginning to think, are there things they could do, perhaps with regulation and supervision or rhetoric, that would discourage bubbles? And there's a big ferment inside the Federal Reserve about what have we learned from this crisis, and should we do things here in the United States to avoid a repeat of this horrible experience?
Well, we just have a few seconds left, but is it likely that the U.S. would do anything?
I think that we don't know yet. It's just you can see this intellectual activity at the Fed as they try to plan for something they're afraid will happen someday in the future.
David, thanks very much.
A pleasure.
David Wessel is economics editor of the Wall Street Journal.
One of the strange facts about our healthcare system is there are no clear prices. NPR's Planet Money team recently explored that conundrum in a story from Pensacola, Florida. One hospital there charges $900 for a shoulder MRI. You can get the same MRI down the street for half that, $450. Today, NPR's Hannah Jaffe-Walt takes the MRI pricing search abroad.
You've heard this story before. A guy goes into the hospital with a problem. Weeks later, sits with a shocking bill, shaking his head.
That's the MRI of the lumbar spine. With total charges submitted by the hospital of $2,352.96, Aetna had a negotiated rate of $1,731 just for an MRI of the lumbar spine, which is a fairly routine study. It's a lot of money.
Typical story, right? But listen to who this guy is.
Howard Foreman. I am a professor of diagnostic radiology and also of management, also of public health, and also of economics at Yale University.
A radiologist, a public health specialist, and healthcare economist who was shocked decades into his career to find out how much an MRI costs. Okay, test. If you just tell me your name and your title.
Naoki Kigami, Professor of Health Policy and Management at Keio University School of Medicine.
A comparison, Professor Ikegami, also a healthcare economist, although he's in Japan, and he has had many, many MRIs. And do you know how much an MRI costs in Japan?
$160.
You know exactly the number?
Right.
Hear that number? $160. And just in case you forgot, Dr. Foreman's MRI, $1,700. So how does Japan work this incredible magic? By law. The government sets the prices. But how does that work? I mean, costs are costs, right? We have to buy MRI machines, so does Japan. We have to pay the electricity bill, so does Japan. There's staff and supplies. You can't just force costs to be low. If you could, you'd make it a dollar for an MRI. I mean, how is it possible that you're doing a procedure for so much less than what we do it for?
$2,000, I would think, is a state-of-the-art MRI, most expensive type.
Oh, so we have better machines? They're different machines.
In general, you have the more expensive types.
In the U.S., we tend to demand the best state-of-the-art machines available. But they're not that much fancier. It doesn't explain a more than tenfold difference in price. So another possible explanation can be found by typing MRI into a Japanese search engine. This is something I asked Dr. Michiko Kinura Bruno to do. She's a Japanese-trained neurologist. And she gets all these ad results, including one that offers to satisfy your MRI needs in a spa-like environment. In Japan, you can buy a less fancy MRI machine, and then you can make up the cost fast because MRIs are incredibly popular. Now, it's unclear if MRIs are popular because they're cheap or if they're cheap in part because they're popular. So I have two more quick theories for you. We here in the U.S. pay our radiologists much more than Japan does, so that's a cost. And then there's this from Professor Gerard Anderson at Johns Hopkins.
I'm talking about the MRI machine. When you go and you buy it from Siemens or General Electric or any of the manufacturers, you'll be paying about twice as much in the United States for the exact same machine.
Japan sets the price they pay for MRIs super low, and so to get into the Japanese market, the manufacturers lower their prices. They charge more here in the U.S. because we'll pay more. How come? Well, I called a number of American hospitals and doctors, and I got basically two reactions. The first and most popular, a shrug. We could never get those prices. That's just how it is. And the second, some were surprised. Just like that radiologist getting his first MRI, healthcare prices, even to them, are something of a mystery. Chana Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to straightforward banking, including customer service with a real human being 24/7. Learn more at allybank.com. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The massive economic stimulus bill may not be stimulating as many jobs as the government says. The website recovery.gov says 640,000 jobs have been created or saved. But the head of the board that tracks stimulus spending tells Congress he can't certify that number is, as he says, accurate and auditable.
Over the last few days, there have been reports of major errors on the website, jobs created in congressional districts that don't exist, and companies counting raises as jobs saved. On The Daily Show last night, Vice President Joe Biden acknowledged some errors, but he said the jobs listed on the website are real.
Go to a zip code, go to Second and Vine. If there is a crosswalk project there, you can push on it, tell you how much was spent, who built it, How many jobs were there?
Well, in the spirit of the vice president's challenge, NPR's Martin Kosty set out to find the stimulus jobs in his neighborhood.
I live in Seattle, so let's go to recovery.gov, type in a nearby zip code to find out who has a stimulus job around here. There's a map, and here's a blue dot that looks like a good candidate to start with. You click on that, and it says $25,000 in stimulus money went to Early Music America Incorporated. It's a nonprofit for people who enjoy the sound of lutes and sackbuts. According to the website, the stimulus money saved 0.5 jobs there, so I went there and asked the director, Baroque flutist Maria Coldwell, to point out that half job.
It's actually 2.25 jobs, to be honest. It's a quarter of my salary and a quarter of Patrick's salary.
She waves at her colleague on the other side of the cramped office. But did the stimulus actually save their jobs?
Before we got this money, we were projecting 2-week furloughs for the whole staff, plus a cutback in hours, and this money made all of that unnecessary.
So no job was saved, but some income definitely was. This job equivalency math gets more complicated at bigger organizations. Take this blue dot here on the government's map of Seattle. If you click on it, it says, as of September 30th, $417,000 of stimulus money went to a company called Amnis, and that created exactly one new job. Amnis makes super microscopes.
So this is the ImageStream X, and it images cells at 1,000 cells a second and produces 12 images of each cell at the same time.
Company co-founder David Basigi says research labs are now getting stimulus grants to buy more of these microscopes.
Right here you can see almost $1 million worth of product that we would not have sold had there not been a stimulus program.
When a government lab uses stimulus money to buy one of these, it's Amnis that gets stuck with the task of reporting to the government how many jobs were created. Basigi says he has to file those reports quarterly for every machine he sells. Not that he minds if it means closing another sale. And as the blue dot on the map said, so far he's reported one new job. We walk over to a workbench to meet Stephanie Varhola. She's a little surprised to be nominated as the company's stimulus hire.
I feel special in a way, but I don't really feel like it was the stimulus.
It's hard to say why any job exists. The inaccuracies on recovery.gov suggest that the government may be claiming credit for too many jobs, but Jill Satrin says she thinks the opposite is true.
I feel really comfortable in those numbers.
She oversees stimulus accountability in Washington State, and she says despite glitches in the data, the overall job count seems conservative.
These jobs number capture the transportation construction worker who's building the road, but it does not capture the jobs, say, through the gravel supplier, and it doesn't capture the jobs that are, you know, in the local restaurants when the construction worker gets off work and goes to have lunch.
And in some cases, the government website actually fails to list jobs directly funded by the stimulus. For instance, it lists zero jobs saved or created at this blue dot on the map of Seattle, the one representing a charity called Solid Ground.
I'm going to need that, and then we'll be square.
Packing bags of groceries to be delivered to shut-ins, Amy Saul says the funding picture for this food program was looking bleak this summer.
I don't want to know. I just want to know if this is going to keep going or not.
But then a stimulus grant came through. Technically, the program won't tap that money until January, which means Saul's job hasn't even been counted yet on the website. But she's convinced that if it weren't for the stimulus, she'd be out of work right now. Again, it's hard to say what might have been. But if you multiply that across the country, you start to see why the grand total of jobs saved and created by the stimulus is not so much a statistic as it is a matter of opinion. Martin Kosty, NPR News.